Hello, Wisconsin. Welcome back to As Goes Wisconsin. No matter where you're listening across the Civic Media Network or on the Civic Media app, thank you for tuning in on your lunch hour. If you've missed any part of today's show, you can always listen to the whole thing or individual interviews as a podcast, either at asgoeswisconsin.com/listen or wherever you find podcasts. And so during the break, we got a couple texts from what we were talking about before, right, Jane?
We did. We weren't sure if the special election had been set for the 8th District, and texter from the 608 said, yes, Governor Evers has announced the election for the same time as the Supreme Court race. And then 507 checking in when we were talking about the down payment on a house and what the minimum down payment is right now. 507 says, my son-in-law is a mortgage broker. Minimum down payment now, 3.5%. So $10,000, a big help.
Yeah, absolutely.
For a down payment. So thanks, you guys, very much.
We love getting texts and calls from you because we don't know everything. Contrary to popular belief, I do not know everything. So keep them coming, 844-967-2789. But our topic for this half hour, I think, affects a lot of people. It affects people all over the country right now, whether it's you personally or a loved one. Because I saw this article in NPR that was the headline was, hospitals have specialists on call for lots of diseases, but not addiction. Why not? And I saw that, and I immediately thought of my dear friend, Dr. Scott Saunders, who is a board-certified internist practicing hospital medicine at University of Colorado Hospital in Denver, because not only is he an MD, who, by the way, was the chief resident when he did his residency at UW-Madison, but he also, last time we were all together, we told me that he's now certified also in addiction medicine and being a specialty in that. And it wasn't until reading this article that I realized what a niche he's filling in right now. And so here to talk to us about the need for this specialist in hospitals, but that we're not necessarily having, is Dr. Scott Saunders. Thank you so much for joining us.
Of course. Thank you so much for having me. I'm so happy to be here.
So I guess, the crux of this story is that what we all know is that there is a crisis with opioid and fentanyl addiction and overdoses, and the opportunity for hospitals to be kind of the crucial impasse to intervene and treat people suffering from addiction, it could make a huge difference. But there's just, most hospitals don't have specialists available who know how to treat addiction. And so was that your motivation for even wanting to go advance, like get more education and get specialized in this, because you saw that there was like kind of a dearth there?
So yeah, it wasn't my realization myself, but we have a faculty member at the University of Colorado named Dr. Susan Calcaterra, who is board certified herself. I think she was boarded in 2018 around then. And she ended up getting a grant to train 10 of us hospitalists, not in an official fellowship, but to basically catch us up with enough knowledge of the medicine to staff a consult service. So she saw the need at our hospital for that and then trained a bunch of us up and staffed this consult service with the goal of getting us all board certified in the next several years. So that's how I got into it.
So to back up a little bit, because I'll totally admit, even though we're good friends, What is a hospitalist? And so, like, when you went through med school in your residency to be a hospitalist, what does that cover as far as being an MD in a hospital?
Yeah, so I'm a general practitioner in the terms of just, I practice general internal medicine. And so through internal medicine, you can either become a general practitioner and just stop there after residency and become like a primary care doctor, or practice general medicine in the hospital, or you can go on and do fellowships and subspecialize to a lot of things that people have heard of, like cardiology, pulmonology, lung doctors, things like that. So as a hospitalist, I practice general medicine in the hospital, and I usually tell people my age, like if your parents are admitted to the hospital with a common medical diagnosis, I'll probably be the one taking care of them. And if there's multiple specialists that are needed, I'll be kind of the quarterback of the team and kind of guide their care.
So then, as you've now gone through training to be specialized in addiction treatment, What did that look like as compared to all of your training and all of your med school and your residency? And was that just information that was totally void in everything you learned before as far as what you needed to learn to be able to do these bedside consults?
Yeah, it was. I was chatting with some of my residency colleagues earlier this week about what we experienced in residency with addiction medicine. And it's vastly different than how I practice now and how I teach my students and resident doctors. So there's been a huge shift, I think, in how residency programs approach addiction medicine. It's a required part of training for internal medicine physicians where it didn't used to be. So that has hugely changed. And for most subspecialties, you have to complete a fellowship. And that's where things are trending with addiction medicine. So in 2025, you'll have to do a true blue fellowship where you go somewhere, train there for a year. That's all you're doing. But in kind of the development of any subspecialties throughout the history of medicine in America, at least when people subspecialize enough on their own, let's say they did enough eye medicine, eventually they, you know, a board forms and people decide, well, people probably should have actual training in eye medicine. And so at that point, they'll grandfather a lot of people in. You know, if you've been doing ophthalmology for 30 years, just because that's how you niched yourself, they'll grandfather you in and you may have to take boards and things like that, but you don't have to do that, you know, that actual fellowship training. So I'm being grandfathered in and I took my boards in October. So I'm board eligible, hopefully board certified very soon when I pass it. But that's kind of, this is such a new area and a new need in America that the system is catching up to the practice that's happening.
Because, you know, I think, and it sounds like from reading this article and talking to you, that both on the side of doctors and employees of hospitals, but also patients themselves and even patients of loved ones, the mental switch of treating addiction as a disease versus a moral failing, and that it is something that requires more than just self-control and discipline to get over this. And so is that kind of the big switch that you've seen as far as getting this training and how doctors are being hopefully trying to switch how they approach someone who is also struggling with addiction?
100%. And the flow of patient care is totally different when I'm on the addiction medicine service, because I get to sit down and spend an hour with the patient. And I basically, my opening question to them is, you know, hey, I'm with this consult service. I'm here to help people that may be struggling with X, Y, or Z substance that I know they struggle with. And I say, I hear that that's really impacted your life. Do you mind telling me how it's impacted your life? And, you know, when I have my internal medicine hat on, I'm typically going in saying like, hey, how are you feeling today? Okay, that's great. Here's going to be our plan for the day. Here's the specialist I'm talking to. I'll circle back with you later when I have more info. You know, so I get to sit down and really hear people's life stories. And some of these patients, it's like, well, yeah, of course you became addicted to whatever, you know, you were so set up to fail by all these things in your life that you couldn't control. And you also get to hear kind of how much they have struggled with whatever they're using. You know, I would say upper 90s% of the people that I see in the hospital that struggle with substance use don't want to be using that substance. You know, they're no longer enjoying it. They're not getting euphoric from anything they're using. It's really just hurting their life. And they're, especially with opioids, people are mainly using to stay out of withdrawal, so to feel normal. And so hearing that and actually kind of getting to build my own empathy for people that struggle with this was huge for me. And so that's one thing that I really, you know, when I have residents and students that come through, I spend a lot of time talking with them about that, because I think, you know, if I see that same person with my internal medicine hat on, I may have 10 or 15 minutes with them while I'm rounding. And as you could imagine, if somebody's feeling really terrible because they're withdrawing, because their life is, you know, completely falling apart around them, it's really hard to be a likable person in that situation, right? Yeah. You feel terrible. And so I think healthcare providers can get the wrong sense of who a person is, and it makes it easy to just write them off and say, well, they're just, that's just not a nice person. And, you know, they don't deserve the same kind of treatment somebody else might. And so building that empathy for our own providers, I think has been a huge part of my own growth and also the growth for my learners.
We're talking to Dr. Scott Saunders, who is an internist at University of Colorado Hospital, but also is recently an addiction treatment specialist. And so we're talking about the need for more of you, basically, in hospitals across the country. As a country, we have such a crisis in opioid overdose. But what also one of the things I learned in this article, the NPR article that I found, was that disclosing an addiction can sometimes make it hard for that person to then find housing or a job or even sometimes medical care in other hospitals. It sounds like not yours. But so how often are you dealing with potential, like they come, like a patient comes in for something else and you kind of have to get it out of them that they're also struggling with addiction because they don't even want to admit that to a doctor?
Yeah, good question. I think one of the biggest ideas in addiction medicine is that, a person to feel ready to change and want to change in some capacity. Typically for opioids, people, if they don't want to talk to me, that's totally fine. I'll respect that. But I will say to them, one thing I don't want to happen is I don't want you to go through withdrawal and be miserable while you're here. So if you're concerned about that, let me know. I'll make sure we manage that appropriately and keep you comfortable. And if they say I'm not, then I say, okay, sounds good. Our team's here if you need us. People will get frustrated, I think, if a urine drug screen shows positive for a drug and the patient doesn't want to talk about it or doesn't, admit it if they ask them. And it's really like, well, if they want help and they want to talk to us about it, they will. And that's totally fine. So kind of giving them the agency to control that part of their care, I think, is an important part of how we approach them.
But Scott, in order to effectively treat someone, you really need all of that information. If someone comes in with a broken arm and they're addicted to opioid, you need to know all of that in order to effectively take care of them.
That's true. And I'll say the biggest thing would be like if somebody starts withdrawing from a substance, but people are really open. I mean, unless they're just fooling me and I'm not, people are just lying to me and I don't know. But generally, especially if somebody uses opioids and if you approach them and say, hey, I'm here to help you in any way that I can, that you think is appropriate, people are really responsive to that. And I think it's such a way that a lot of people have not been treated in a hospital before. Like just coming to them like a person and saying, I'm just trying to make you comfortable. So generally people are really frank, which was kind of surprising to me too when I started this, but they'll tell you what's going on and they truly don't want to withdraw. That's like a pretty horrendous experience for people. And so if that's on the table that we can help keep them out of that, they're generally quite honest.
It's so interesting because I think, and we're going to keep you through the commercial break because I think it's also interesting because of thinking about addiction as, like we said, a disease and something that I think, I assume that some people are more predetermined to fall prey to because of background biology. And so I want to talk about more about that as far as like how much it changes depending on what the addiction is to, and also how that changes treatment plans. And then any ideas you have as far as like how hospitals can invest more in people like you, because it seems like this is something that there's a unique opportunity to help people while they are in the hospital versus just waiting for them to try to find help. And so we are going to keep Dr. Scott Saunders through the commercial break. If you have any questions for him, he'll be here for another 8 minutes in the next segment. So 844-967-2789. This is As Goes Wisconsin. Stay with us. to As Goes Wisconsin with Kristen Bry. We are talking to Dr. Scott Saunders, who is a board-certified internist practicing hospital medicine and addiction medicine at University of Colorado Hospital, about the need for more doctors and hospitals and or specialists in general to be treating addiction when patients come in that need that kind of help. And it's something that, I guess, as a country, we have a lack of currently. And I think we had a question that's a caller in that came in over the break.
We did. We had a caller from the Rapids wondering, Scott, because you're in Colorado, do you know, are there any hospital facilities in Wisconsin that offer what your facility is offering in Colorado?
Yeah, so I was chatting with some of my colleagues at the University of Wisconsin because I thought if I'm going to be on a Wisconsin radio show, I should probably know what's happening. So in Madison, I know there's a similar group of providers, like addiction medicine specialists, social work, case managers, things like that, that will help. I'm not sure about in the other cities around the state, but at least at the university, they have that. And then I talked to, you know, one of the biggest issues with this is linkage to care. So it's great if you can start somebody on a medicine like Suboxone or methadone in the hospital, but it doesn't really do much for somebody if you can't get them follow up in a nearby clinic where they can continue that treatment as an outpatient. So talking to my primary care friends, that's been a barrier for how do you set that clinic up for people? Who staffs it? Is it primary care doctors? Is it addiction medicine providers? Trying to build that infrastructure as we go, I think has been a challenge for probably everybody around the country.
Well, and I would imagine, I have no numbers to back this up, but I mean, in that article, they said 1 in 9 hospitalized patients has a history of an addiction to drugs or alcohol, which is a wildly huge number. But I think there's so much, we hear so much about opioids and fentanyl, largely, I think, because that's where there's a lot of overdoses. And like you said, the withdrawal from that is horrendous. But how much does the treatment plan change with someone who is an alcoholic or addicted to cocaine? And is there, because there's not like a supplement methadone plan, I would say, in the same way it seems like there is for opioids.
Yeah, so you're exactly right. So for opioids, we've got two fantastic medicines that are the gold standard of treatment. So Suboxone and methadone. So relapse rates are incredibly high if your plan in the hospital is to just come off of opioids and stay off of them, not replace that with anything with any
cold
medication.
Turkey. Yeah,
right. Unfortunately, we don't have those same medicines for other use disorders. So for alcohol, we have a few that we could offer. You know, everyone's heard of antabuse, where you get sick if you drink while you're taking it. We don't really use that anymore. We have the two main medicines that we use would be naltrexone and acamprosate, which help decrease cravings for alcohol. But for basically for every use disorder besides opioids, the other parts of treatment become that much more important. Things like any kind of rehab, whether that's inpatient or outpatient, things like group meetings. Everyone's heard of AA, but there's so many different types of meetings out there. I tell my patients, whatever kind of person you are, there is a group of you meeting outside somewhere talking about this. You know, we have, there's like Dharma Recovery here in Colorado, which has like, you know, Buddhist inspired approach. There's like Pagans in Recovery. There's outdoor recovery groups. There's all sorts of things like that. And then we also talk to families about, you know, it's hard to be a person with a use disorder, and it's hard to be a person that loves a person with a use disorder. And so having those resources to help family members know, like, how do you set appropriate boundaries with this person that you love so much that you're seeing go through this much suffering? How do you support yourself? How do you support their kids? All those kinds of things. And then also thinking of mental health can be a huge factor in all of these things. So, you know, some people with alcohol use disorder may drink partially because they've got really uncontrolled anxiety. So how do we hook them up with a therapist, with a psychiatrist that can help manage these underlying mental health diagnoses that may be contributing to their use disorder? So, yeah, unfortunately, we don't have those kind of like silver bullet medications, but we still do have a lot of supports that we can help hook people into.
Because I think it was when we were talking that you set it up in such a distinct way that really stuck out, which is why I thought of you immediately when I read this article, which is this idea of a shift in your thought process or the way you think about addiction as being a disease versus a moral failing. And in what you've learned as you've gained this specialty in addiction medicine, like what, how much of someone who, you know, because we talk about an addictive personality. So how much is it, someone who has a use disorder is about their unique biology and, you know, traits that they inherited from family members versus their environment?
Oh, yeah. Interesting question, because I don't think it has to be. I think they can both be true and they interact with each other. So there are certainly some use disorders that are more genetically linked than others. So for alcohol use disorder, if somebody has really severe alcohol use disorder, typically I'm guessing that somebody in their family does as well before I go see them. Whereas things like opioids, it's very much a chemical process in our brains that happens. And so all of us are more likely, if we abused alcohol versus opioids, we're all much more likely to end up with opioid use disorder than we would as a whole with alcohol use disorder. But I think thinking about genetics and your lived experience and kind of traumas that you've gone through, those can impact your genetics. Mm-hmm. Even when we're in the womb, there's something called epigenetics, where our genome gets changed in some ways, and how genes are expressed gets changed. And trauma that your mother goes through can impact how your genes are expressed, for example. And so much of it, there's some of it that's genetic. And then I think so much of it is also, what did you go through growing up? How many adverse childhood events did you go through? What kind of coping mechanisms did you grow up with that did your parents teach you when you're feeling anxious or depressed or things like that? You know, what kind of neighborhood did you grow up with? What kind of people were you surrounded with? What culture was that? And so, depending on your circumstance, that can have a huge impact on whether you end up on a substance or not. And like I said, some of these patients, it's like, man, so many awful things happened to you so young. And, you know, your stepdad introduced you to alcohol when you were 13 and your father had a bad alcohol use disorder. Well, yeah, no wonder you ended up with the same thing, right? You can start out with that genetic link and end up with a lot of traumas on the way that make that more likely.
And when it comes to Wisconsin, you could also just live in Wisconsin.
There's a lot of alcohol there. That's true.
Exactly. And so, well, this has been fascinating. Thank you so much for joining us and telling us about what your specialty has looked like, what it looks like at your hospital, also what it seems like is available also in Wisconsin. But Dr. Scott Saunders, thank you so much for spending time with us today.
Of course. Happy to be here.
All right. Well, we're going to take a break for the top of the hour news. And when we come back, John Gerda will be here. Very much looking forward to that. This is As Goes Wisconsin. Thanks, buddy.
You're welcome. So fun. Talk to
you. Yes.
Bye, guys.
So you were great. I'll text you later.